Thank you. Morning. Morning, everybody. My printer's broken, so I'm going tech this morning. So if it doesn't work, help us, please, Lord. but yeah, thanks, John. Thanks for leading worship this morning. And I hope you're all doing well. We came back from off holiday yesterday. I took Ben on a speedy surprise trip to the beach, which was a flying trip to the beach. But we had a lovely time, so that was good. If you don't know me, if you're new, if you're visiting, my name's Vicky. I usually lead worship with my husband, Ben. And I've got two little ones that more than likely will come and interrupt today's sermon. So apologies in advance if you were here for worship 2 weeks ago. Thank you for your patience. So this morning, John asked me to speak on anything. And honestly, the type A personality that I am, a little bit inside of me was like, and I rang John and was like, are you sure you don't have a topic? Maybe a theme? A verse, John. Anything? Give me a nugget, please. And he was like, no, just see what God wants to speak on. So I decided to do what any sane-minded person would do. And I began my long list of mundane jobs that I have at home in order to give my brain some space to listen to God and to wait for that nugget. So 3 months later, after John asked me to preach, I have decorated 4 rooms in my house. I've jet washed my drive and I've painted our front fence. So, and we finally arrived at today's sermon. So I tell you this, frankly, because when you paint a black fence black, nobody knows that you've painted it. So you know those jobs at home that you do and nobody notices? Now you all know that I have painted my fence. So if you ever come to my home, please comment on how beautiful my black painted fence is. So today we're going to dive into a beautiful blend of some poetry, a little bit of inside-out Disney film. There's some creativity involved, diaries of a CEO, and we might land a little bit in God's word along the way. So it's a blend this morning. So if you like titles for today, I'm going to be speaking on the theme of intertwined. And we're going to be looking at what it looks like to have a life directed by God. So last time I preached back in January, we looked at Ecclesiastes 3. For everything there is a season. And I want to use that as a starting point today. I like to speak on similar things. I don't believe that God jumps around all over the place. So I hope that you see today's sermon as more of a chapter rather than a separate book. And if you weren't here, you can go back and you can catch up on all of those previous ones. So a few years ago during COVID, Ben's lovely nan, who isn't particularly well, decided to move from Redditch to Wales to live with her daughter, who does a wonderful job of caring for her better than she could have and that she was coping by herself in her own home. But when the family sold the house, she was asking people if they would like anything. She went from this big family home to a little room in her daughter's house. So she had to get rid of all of her things. And there was one thing that Ben really wanted from her house, and that was a poem. And that poem had hung there for as long as Ben could remember. And when he was growing up, she talked about it. And this poem obviously had a big imprint on his life. And he's spoken to me about it a number of times. He can remember speaking about it in lessons at school, in RE lessons when he had to do stuff. So he really, really wanted that poem. But sadly, it was lost. We don't know where it went. It went somewhere in the move. It might have been given to charity. But it wasn't important to anybody else. But it had this significance to him. And so I knew how much it meant to him, and I set about finding it and trying to get a copy of it and giving it him for Father's Day. Now, I couldn't find one, but I managed to get a new one printed, and it hangs in his office. And this is the poem. It doesn't look like this, but I'll read it because it's quite tiny. It says, "My life is but a weaving between my God and me. I cannot choose the colours he weaveth steadily. Oftentimes he weaveth sorrow. And I, in foolish pride, forget he sees the upper and I the underside. Not till the loom is silent and the shuttles cease to fly will God unroll the canvas and reveal the reason why. The dark threads are as needful in the weaver's skillful hand as the threads of gold and silver in the pattern he has planned. He knows, he loves, he cares. Nothing this truth can dim. He gives the very best to those who leave the choice to him." That's by Benjamin Malachi Franklin. So I'm going to take you on a journey this morning, and I'd like to introduce you to three people in the Bible who I think live out this poem. And I'm going to zoom into the minutiae of their daily lives and a series of events that God has used for his glory. So I want you to think about your everyday life. And, you know, we might wake up, and I'm not a morning person, so I wake up and I'm, you know, like a little bit sad and grumpy. And then, you know, we have a great time. Sophia did some colouring this morning. It was lovely. Everyone sat a night breakfast and nobody killed each other. So we had a lovely, wonderful time. And then maybe somebody does something and that makes you really angry. And, you know, you go about your day-to-day life and all of us are building and weaving this series of tiny situations that go to make us who we are. And this morning, there are three people, and those people are Naomi, Ruth, and Boaz. And their story is found in the shortest book of the Old Testament. There's no joke, John, that I picked the shortest book to preach from. It's a small book written about a small family in a small town with nothing particular of note. From the outside looking in, the family have been quite blessed. Their weaving is looking very colourful. They have not just had one son, but they've had two sons, which in that ancient culture was a great blessing. But disaster strikes, and the family are forced to move to Moab from Bethlehem due to a famine in the land. Now, the Moabites were descended from Lot, and Lot was the nephew of Abraham. If you have heard Lot and wondering where he is, he went to Sodom and Gomorrah. His wife got turned to salt. There was a whole thing with his daughters. Let's not go into that. And you can read it if you want, but I won't preach about the children here. And they're known for their greed, their pride, and for worshipping multiple false gods. So the decision to move from Bethlehem in Judea with their family and culture and their God to a different culture with different gods and a totally different way of doing life was not an easy decision to make, but they were desperate. They had no food, and they've become intertwined in a culture that was not one that they would have chosen. They frequently clashed with the Israelites, and they ruled the land to the east of the Dead Sea. So we start the story in chapter 1. It is only 4 chapters long. If you want to read it, if today's sermon would have been longer, I would have got 4 of us up and we would have read it for you. It would have taken about 15 minutes. But the whole book is very short, so I do encourage you to have a read. But we start our story in Ruth chapter 1, where Elimelech and his wife Naomi took their two sons and they went to live in Moab. But sadly, Elimelech dies. And we're introduced to the first black thread in the canvas of Naomi's life. Later, her two sons marry, but they marry Moabite women. That's not something that as a family that they would have thought was in their future. Later, the loom keeps filling with colours of their daily life and it keeps going on and on and on. But a cloud overshadows the family. And after 10 years, both sons die. And neither of their wives have any children. As someone who has walked that road of emptiness, that sentence is filled not just with the fact that their husbands died, but that 10 years went by and there were no children. For me, there is a torrent of life experience in that sentence that stopped me in my tracks when I read it. And I don't know if you get that when you read the Bible sometimes, where you just know what it was like in that tiny fraction of a sentence, that you've lived a lifetime in it. But in the Bible, it's just a sentence and the story moves on. We'll come to this later, but when we focus in on that zoomed-in version of our lives, that fraction of a sentence, it can become all-consuming. And yet here in the overview, it barely makes a mention. Well, next, with no reason left to stay, and upon hearing that food has returned to Judea, to Bethlehem, and to her homeland, Naomi decides she's got nothing left, and she will return home to her extended family. But she's implored by her daughters-in-laws to remain with their families. Go back to your families. I'll go alone. Yet Ruth cannot. And here we find one of those famous Bible verses that will sound great on a mug. It's often given to daughter-in-laws at their wedding. Make sure that you're a Ruth. But it's not a cheesy slogan. These are words spoken in desperation from one widow to another when they're left in a world where all they've got are the clothes on their back and each other. And the strand that Ruth is resolved to keep them together is Yahweh, a God that was not her God, but she has chosen in that moment to remain faithful to your God. It says, where you go, I will go, and where you stay, I will stay. Your people will be my people, and your God will be my God. Where you die, I will die, and there I will be buried. May the Lord deal with me, be it ever so severely, if even death separates me from you. I've not even heard marriage vows like that. When Naomi realized that Ruth was determined to go with her, she stopped urging her. She was like, I ain't got a cat in hell's chance of getting this my way. She's obviously coming. So come along for the ride, Ruth. We'll see what happens. So they travel back 50 miles, which would have taken them about 10 days to Bethlehem. Not an easy journey, two women alone, probably with very little food, very little possessions, no protection whatsoever. They travel back to Bethlehem. Bethlehem means the house of bread. And they arrive at the start of the barley harvest, which is symbolic of God's provision in the Bible. And here Naomi meets the women of the town. Now, imagine in 2025, she's come on this long journey. She arrives back in Bethlehem. She walks into town and is surrounded by the women of the town. If all of you got up and came and surrounded me and you were like, is that Vicky? You're not like, oh, is that Vicky? You're like, is that Vicky? Like, she's been gone a long time. Why is she walking back here? Who has she brought with her? Who is this person? And imagine the WhatsApp chat. Yeah, all the women in the town, everything we know about women, they're all a bit gossipy. Yeah, so they're all starting, the WhatsApp chat's pinging, and they're all like chatting about this woman who's come back. Why has she come back? Where is her husband? Where are her two sons that she left with? And why has she brought a random woman with her? And all of a sudden, Ruth announces that they aren't to call her Ruth anymore. The WhatsApp chat says Mara has been added. Now, Mara means bitterness. And it says, when they arrived in Bethlehem, the whole town was stirred because of them. And the women exclaimed, can this be Naomi? Now, I doubt it was said with excitement. She said, don't call me Naomi, she told them. Call me Mara, because the Almighty has made my life very bitter. I went away full. She went away with two sons. She had all the blessing that anybody could ever ask for. But the Lord has brought me back empty. Why call me Naomi? The Lord has afflicted me. The Almighty has brought misfortune upon me. So right now, the canvas of Naomi and Ruth's life is looking like a scene from the Inside Out Disney film. Here we go, film. So, you know, if I carried on with my weaving, has anyone seen it, Inside Out? Yeah? Great film if you haven't. There's also an Inside Out 2. Haven't seen it yet? Please don't spoil it. So we've got loads of memories. There's happy ones and sad ones and angry ones and, like, vengeful ones and greedy ones and sad ones. So there's all these characters and they create different memories, and when they touch them, the memory becomes that emotion. So you can see here we've got Joy on the left, and she's in charge of all of the happy memories, and all of the canvas is full of predominantly happy memories, and that would have been Naomi's life until the famine hit. And then, you know, her life gets harder and harder, but it's gone from this to this. All of a sudden, sadness has taken control. Sadness and bitterness have so overwhelmed Naomi that they have become her very identity. Now, I, for one, can totally relate to this feeling. And I've walked through periods of my life where darkness and the black threads just seem to keep on being woven. In fact, I can distinctly remember going shopping one Christmas with my mother-in-law and her commenting that the things that I liked to buy and the clothes that I was picking out, they were all things that were a bit grey or a bit black. And she was like, why are you picking out sad clothes? Like, don't you want just something a bit more colourful? And there's a tiny voice inside of me that honestly was just like, no. Like, I just can't. I just don't want to. It had so overwhelmed me that even the clothes that I was choosing, without even realising, I made those choices in the day-to-day minutiae of my life were sad. My heart was lamenting, and Naomi and Ruth are still dressed in mourning as they walk into town, and here we find them with no fineries, a symbol of their sadness. Now, I want to pause there. And for a minute, I want you to bear with me and imagine that Naomi is an ant, or maybe a spider. Now, some of you might know where I'm going with this, but I know it's weird. Stick with me. It will all become clear, I promise. But right then, as she stood in the center of town, surrounded by those women, she is, in effect, a little bit like this. Can we play the first video? She even backs herself back in. Have you ever done that? You're like, my life is getting overwhelming and smaller and smaller. And sometimes you're like, do you know what? I just give up so much. I'm just going to put myself back in there. Crazy. I didn't even know that that would happen to a spider or an ant. So all the while there was a famine, then her husband died, then her son died, then another son died, she was drawing more and more circles around herself until even the last remaining people in the world that she loved, her two daughters-in-law, she tried to draw them out of the circle too. But Ruth was steadfast, loyal, and loving, and she refused to be drawn out of the circle. She intertwined herself inside and clung on to Naomi's pain with her own, and the two women stood in the middle of town, strangers, widows, outcasts, and entirely alone. In Ruth 2, desperate for food, Ruth asks Naomi if she can go and pick up scraps from behind the harvesters in the field. It's a near mirror to the New Testament in Matthew 15, where the Canaanite woman begs Jesus to heal her daughter, who is tormented by demons. It says, then Jesus left and went north into the non-Jewish region of Lebanon. He encountered there a Canaanite woman, so Canaanite, like the Moabites, not believing in Yahweh, and shouted at him, Lord, son of David, show mercy upon me. My daughter is horribly afflicted by a demon that torments her. But Jesus never answered her. So his disciples said to him, why do you ignore this woman who is crying to us? Like, she's literally groveling along the floor crying. She's making a bit of a scene here, and they're like, Jesus, just please say something. Why do you ignore this woman? Jesus said, I've only been sent to the lost sheep of Israel. But she came and bowed down before him and said, Lord, help me. Jesus responded, it's not right for a man to take bread from his children and throw it out to the dogs. You're right, Lord, she replied, but even puppies get to eat the crumbs that fall from the prince's table. Then Jesus answered her, dear woman, your faith is strong. What you desire will be done for you. And at that very moment, her daughter was instantly set free from demonic torment. These two women, who weren't Jews, were throwing their lives on God and in desperation, and are both rewarded for their faith and provided with what they need. They're provided with the bread of life. So Ruth happens, by a God incident, to go and to pick up grain in the field of Naomi's relative, Boaz. Boaz asked the overseer of his harvest, who does that young woman belong to? The overseer replied, she is the Moabite, who came back from Moab with Naomi. She said, please let me glean and gather among the sheaves behind the harvesters. So she's not harvesting the main crop. She's not even picking up after the women that are going and picking up the leftovers. She's picking up like the leftover, 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 leftovers, because that's all that she's allowed to pick up. And you can only go and scavenge in other people's land if they let you. And if you go into someone's land that you're not supposed to be in, or they don't really want you there, they'll probably beat you or harm you or do unimaginable things to you, particularly as a woman with no protection whatsoever. So she came into the field and she remained here from morning until now, except for a short rest in the shelter. And that immediately tells us that she's hardworking. She's desperate. So Boaz said to Ruth, calls her over and says, "My daughter, listen to me. Don't go and glean in another field and don't go away from here." He knew how dangerous it was. "Stay here with the women who work for me. Watch the field where the men are harvesting and follow along after the women." So he's not saying follow along with the women, and we're not quite there yet. He's saying follow along after the women. "I have told the men not to lay a hand on you." He's protecting her. "And whenever you're thirsty, go and get a drink from the water jars that the men have already filled." He's providing for her. At this, she bowed down with her face on the ground and she asked him, "Why have I found such favor in your eyes that you notice me, a foreigner?" Boaz replied, "I've been told about you and what you've done for your mother-in-law since the death of your husband, how you left your father and your mother and your homeland and came to live with a people that you did not know. May the Lord repay you for what you have done." He's honoring her character. "May you be richly rewarded by the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come to take refuge." The story that follows shatters the walls that Naomi and Ruth have built. And it kind of does this.
Have you ever seen that video of the ant in the pen?
No.
They get an ant on a piece of paper. And the guy on YouTube, it's like got millions of views on YouTube, just with a biro, draws a circle around the ant. And the ant runs to the edge of the circle and believes it's trapped. And it will not cross that line. It will not cross that line. Looking down on it from a bird's eye view, you go, oh no, that's just a figment of its imagination. They do the same with a spider. They get a piece of paper, there's a little spider on it, they draw a circle around it with a biro. It will not cross that line. As the guy's drawing the circle smaller and smaller, he accidentally draws it so close to the spider that the spider steps over the biro, and then it can never ever in its life be trapped by the biro again. And you watch it just run off the page, and he's trying to trap it again, and it can never, because it realizes that, that's just a wall it's built in its mind. You, me, we have drawn circles around ourselves, but they are just figments of our imagination. Have you ever seen?
So that's the moment that shatters those walls. And we're introduced to Boaz. Now, Boaz in Ruth 3 is described as the family's kinsman redeemer. I don't know if any of you have ever looked at that or know what it is, but it's a position held within a family of the closest male relative. And as people went off and got married, they would separate out the property, and that property belonged to that new kind of nuclei family. If anything happened to that nuclei family, then it was the kinsman redeemer's responsibility to keep that land and that property within the possession of the wider family. So we kind of hear about it in the son who goes and says, the prodigal son. We kind of hear about it in the prodigal son, where he separates his land and he sends it off and he wastes it away, but he comes back and the father redeems it. That's in the New Testament. But in the Old Testament, there is a role within a family called the kinsman redeemer. So Ruth is aware that Boaz is their kinsman redeemer and that by law, it's his responsibility to protect them and keep them safe. Now, God just so happens to have brought them to Boaz's land, but they've got to do a little bit of the work. So the whole of chapter 3 is Ruth basically Naomi basically informing Ruth of this loophole and this reason how they could be saved and how they could be kept safe, and gives her a series of instructions about what to do. So in Ruth 3, Boaz goes about fulfilling his duty, and he basically buys up the property of those three men that have died. So Elimelech had two sons, and he will have split his land between his two sons. Ruth's husband will have had that land, but those men aren't here anymore. So there is land just wasting away with nobody doing anything to it, just waiting for somebody else to take it. It's not just the land, it's any belongings of those men. And as a woman in that culture, it is the women who are the belongings. So it's important that they buy up those belongings and that they stay in the family and that they keep their family name. So it's not Boaz's family name, it's the men who have died's family name, even though they're Boaz's possessions. So he goes about doing that. There's a drama in the middle where they find a closer relative than Boaz, so a closer kinsman redeemer. And they go to that kinsman redeemer, and he gets all of the important men to surround him. And he says, right, it's your responsibility to buy up this land. Do you want it? And he goes, yeah, I'll have that land. It's good land. I'm not going to waste it. And he was like, but by the way, it's all of the possessions. So there's this Moabite woman, and you'll have to marry her. And he goes, oh, no, that would bring, like, dishonor on my family. I don't want to be married to a Moabite. Can you imagine what would happen? Like, it would all kick off at home. I'm not having that. You take her. So there's this whole weird section in the middle. Boaz steps in, he fulfills the law, and he marries Ruth. There's a weird bit in the middle where they exchange shoes to finalize the transaction. And, like, that just feels weird to me. Like, I can imagine Ben going and seeing my dad and being like, can I marry Vicky? And he says, yeah, hang on a minute. Takes off a shoe, swaps it. Now, my dad's got size 11 feet. Ben's got size 7. So for the rest of his life, he's hobbling around. Because, like, I have multiple shoes. They didn't back then. They're hobbling around with, like, a size 7 and a size 11. Like, the two of them are uncomfortable, and they're reminded of this decision for a long time. So they get married, and she conceives and gives birth to a son. Bear in mind that she hasn't had a son for 10 years with her other husband, but she conceives and gives birth to a son through Boaz. And slowly over time, the tapestry of these two women's lives becomes more colourful. Can you imagine? Like, she gets married, yay, like, we're saved, we're protected, this is great. But there's other people in the house, and we're, like, still bottom of the ranking. But then she finds out that she's pregnant, and we're, like, joy, joy, joy over here. And, you know, if you're like me, you were really sick during pregnancy. So there's, like, a whole heap of, like, emotions going on there. And then she gives birth, and she finds out it's a son. Everyone is like, joy, 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 joy. This is the most colourful tapestry you've ever seen. And slowly over time, the two women's lives become more colourful, until this defining moment in Ruth 4, where God weaves the golden thread. So what does the book of Ruth really teach us today? Well, it teaches us to trust in the Lord with all of your heart, lean not on your own understanding. It's one of Ben's favorite verses. In all your ways, acknowledge him, and he will direct your path. By Ruth's own zoomed-in vision of her circumstances, she was trapped. She was left with only bitterness as a companion, and by ancient standards, she was the lowest of the low. She had no husband, no sons, no prospect of remarrying, no prospect of bearing any more sons, and the life and culture in Israel was defined by your connection to a man. Yet it was ultimately Naomi's connection to Ruth that defined her, redeemed her, and saved her, taking her from the pit of bitterness to how we find her in chapter 4, verses 13 to 17. And I like to think that if the story was made into a film, that they'd probably be playing Sovereign Over Us at this moment as, like, the theme tune. So Ruth 4, 13, 17, Naomi gains a son. Not Ruth, Naomi. So Boaz took Ruth, and she became his wife. When he made love to her, the Lord enabled her to conceive, and she gave birth to a son. The women said to Naomi, praise be to the Lord, who this day has not left you without a guardian redeemer, kinsman redeemer. May he become famous throughout all of Israel. I mean, the laughs on them, isn't it? Like, oh, this is amazing. May he be famous. Like, he's going to be dead famous, like, written in the Bible, preached about 2,500 years later, kind of famous. He will renew your life and sustain you in your old age. It's like a pension. He's going to sustain you in your old age. For your daughter-in-law who loves you and who is better to you than 7 sons has given him birth. Then Naomi took the child in her arms and cared for him. The women living there said, Naomi has a son. And they named him Obed. He was the father of Jesse, who was the father of David, who became king of Israel. Now, I can just imagine that we've got this WhatsApp chat going, you know, years before, they're all like, who's this woman? And now Ruth gives birth to a son. And Naomi's WhatsApp chat with her friends is going nuts. Like, oh, it's a boy. I'm so happy for you. Congratulations, grandma. No, like they're not buying her grandma cards and they're not sending her balloons and they're not giving her gifts. It might sound like an over-exaggeration, but remember, Naomi has nothing to her own name. Absolutely nothing. She is only connected to that family by her daughter-in-law from a previous marriage. The only way for her to survive is through the charity of her extended family, Boaz. And yet Ruth does something more. She gives Naomi the position of caring for Obed, not just as a grandma, but recognized by the community and the law as if she herself had given birth to a son. Now, you can find this in Ruth 4, verse 10, but this is in effect giving her a pension, a place in the household. She's giving her food, position, respect, and love. They're not proclaiming, congratulations, well done. They're not all passing around a card. It's in effect as if she herself had given birth to that baby boy, a son who would ultimately go on to be the grandfather of King David and the ancestor of Jesus, whose name means servant or worshipper, a direct foreshadowing of the role that David would have in Israel and ultimately that Jesus would have. They've carried that thread of worship throughout their whole family line because they're from the family of Judah, which means praise. So Obed takes on the last name of Naomi and Ruth, not that of Boaz. And it intertwines Ruth, the Moabite, into the lineage of Jesus Christ. The golden thread has been woven. Now that is immeasurably more than Naomi could have asked or imagined. A golden thread woven into the life of ordinary people that intertwined them into God's tapestry. We can often feel like our life is meaningless. If you listen to my previous sermon, it's called Hevel. If you feel like it's Hevel, it's all Hevel, it's all meaningless, and it just drifts into nothing. But with God, all things are possible. He alone is our Redeemer. He alone can work all things for the good of those who love him. Our choice to follow him weaves a golden thread. In that moment that you choose him, that golden thread is spun into our lives and it irrevocably changes the course and the outcome. In Hebrews 12, we read, therefore, since we are surrounded by such a great cloud of witnesses, let us throw off everything that hinders. All of those lines that you've drawn around yourself. Throw them off. Break the chains and the sin that so entangles us and let us run with perseverance, the race marked out for us, fixing our eyes on Jesus, the pioneer and perfecter of our faith. For the joy set before him, he endured the cross, scorning its shame, and sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. Consider him who endured such opposition from sinners, so that you will not grow weary and lose heart. The path is already marked out before us. The sovereign Lord has ordered our steps. We just need to trust in him with all our heart and allow him to direct us, as he did Naomi and Ruth, to the field of their Redeemer. I don't know whereabouts in the story of your life you are right now. I don't know what colours the Lord is weaving into your life or the circumstances that face you when you walk out that door. But I've come to learn that if I cling to God, if we bind ourselves to the vine and abide in him, if we lean on his word, that ultimately one day we will unroll the canvas with him and we'll see the other side. Thank you.